a scene that has long since ceased causing any surprise. The women folk washing dishes made of plastic, dishes that bounce when they drop to the floor. Hard to realize it, but it was only 10 years ago that the first pound of polyesterine plastic was sold.
And the chemical age is just dawning. These few things, my friends, are only a hint of what American industry holds in the future.
Yes, Mylar's properties are right in its molecules. And with them are coming new and better things for us all.
Today will be a better day for a lot of people. Simply because of a material we call plastic.
This industry is well positioned to build on our accomplishments, to shape a sustainable and prosperous future. In summary, we believe the best is yet to come.
I think, like many people, I had noticed a real surge of attention and interest in the issue of plastic pollution. This article came about from conversations with activists who are working on plastics issues. Oftentimes, what I do is ask people that are close to an issue how they feel about the media coverage. And one thing I was consistently hearing was that there was a gap in coverage when it came to the front end of the story. So there was a ton of attention around the final stage of the plastics life cycle, when it actually becomes pollution. But not as many people were telling the story about where plastic comes from.
You can never solve the plastic waste crisis just by dealing with it as a waste issue. Who is making the plastics in the first place and why?
The history of plastics began over 30 million years ago when intense heat, natural chemical changes, and tremendous pressures created by the shifting of the Earth's crust formed the substance needed to make plastic, petroleum.
99% of what goes into plastics is fossil fuels. And so, unsurprisingly, the same companies that make plastics are also the companies that sell us fossil fuels. Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Shell, and Dow DuPont, which in addition to being a major chemicals company, is also a major player in oil and gas. Plastics were initially a waste product. The company could either pay to dispose of the leftovers responsibly, or it could turn them into a new product.
Oil companies compete with each other in taking the petroleum molecule apart and rearranging it into, well, you name it, fabrics, toothbrushes, tires, insecticides, cosmetics, weed killers, a whole galaxy of things to make a better life on Earth.
Just as there are many kinds of woods and metals, so there are many kinds of plastics. This is plexiglass tube, one of the most fascinating and beautiful of the new plastic materials created by chemical science, ready to bring new beauty and comfort to your home and add charm to your peacetime living.
Plastic is a miracle material. When it was created, it was hailed as the biggest invention of the time. It's extremely durable. It lasts very, very long. And so the reality is that because plastic has all these good qualities, it's extremely bad for the environment.
I was a corporate lawyer for 6 years, and then I decided to leave it to work on something that I actually cared about and where I actually had a personal stake in the outcome. 15 years ago, I could still go to a pristine beach and collect seashells. And it makes me sad to think that some of the children born today, and even my own daughter, won't have the memory of a cleaner world.
I just want her to be aware of why her world is the way it is, and that it could be better.
I feel like I don't know how to answer anymore when people say, why are you focusing on plastic? Why is plastic a problem? I mean, I feel like I should just take them here and not say anything, just take them here and then see what they think, whether they think plastic bags are not a problem anymore.
I can still remember a time when I was still a teenager and this wasn't a problem. So we're not talking about decades. We're talking about maybe 10 to 15 years of this kind of lifestyle.
A lot of the single-use plastics that end up polluting our planet, we only use them once and they stay forever. They're made of a material that lasts forever. They're not something that we need as an essential part of our lives. And yet here we are, stuck with it.
Unfortunately, data are coming back that plastics really are a significant component of the waste that enters the ocean. So that's largely a matter of poorly or unmanaged municipal solid waste. Mm-hmm. Parts of the world, unlike here, where there is not an infrastructure to gather and appropriately dispose of the waste.
I think what's most frustrating is that the industries are out there pushing the idea that this is all because of bad management. You know, that the waste is here because the government isn't putting enough funding into proper waste management. But they're distracting from the truth, which is that there's no way you can manage this waste. It's not meant to be managed. I think we should band together and have a serious discussion on a global scale, because these companies are operating on a global scale.
The issue of waste and plastic pollution, it is about this deeply embedded injustice that really motivates me to keep doing what I'm doing. We are standing in Ghazipur D Block Dairy Farm, next to the landfill which receives waste from almost half of Delhi. तो आप यहाँ पे कितने साल से हैं?
तकरीबन 20 साल.
क्योंकि धूल मिट्टी इतनी है, अब कारोबार है, यहाँ रहना पड़ता, अब कहाँ जाएं और?
Plastic products are only creating a mountain of waste in India.
Trash only becomes trash after it has first served a useful purpose. The art of modern packaging has helped to make our outings even more enjoyable. But it is these wonderful packages, thoughtlessly discarded, which we carelessly convert to litter.
I think in a lot of discussions of various environmental problems, we put a lot of onus on
people start pollution. People can stop it.
And I do think that there is a place for that, but I think that that often has the effect of obscuring the big structural issues that are driving many of these environmental problems. And the fact that the people that are profiting off of creating environmental issues are not being asked to change.
On a personal level, I have stopped using plastic bags and plastic straws. And that's a great thing, but you realize at the systematic level, that doesn't change anything. I grew up in an island, enjoying nature. When I was in college, I moved to Manila to study. The first thing that struck me when I arrived here was the amount of waste that's on the bay. This is not what I want for my island, the place where I grew up. And I know if I don't do something, that will happen.
plastic pollution. It's really a life and death issue for most people, at least in this part of the world. Manila Bay is like a cove, and there's several provinces located along that coastline. So whatever the currents bring in from outside, they stay within that cove. And whatever waste is deposited to the bay from the rivers also stays there. Every day, day in, day out, there's cleaning operations going on. It's unending. You can do cleanups and the problem will not go away. You have to look at the root causes. We can't be doing cleanups all our lives. This is not a solution. We're an archipelagic country and we depend on fish and seafood for sustenance. It is pretty much part of the Filipino lifestyle and culture. Ilang porsyento ng kukuha nyo sa regular na pangingisda nyo plastic?
Siguro ang halos sa ngayon ay 60-40.
60-40? 60% fish? Or 60% plastic?
60%
fish, pero 40% plastic. Yes. The stuff we read about saying there'll be more plastics in the oceans than fish in 2050, that's actually a reality for most of these fishermen. And a lot of this is really unrecyclable plastics. A great percentage are really multi-layer packaging. The sachets that you find, like this one, you cannot recycle this. Nobody bothers to collect them, that's why they end up here. Who bears the burden of this pollution? You have the marginal communities, coastal communities, the fishing communities, and the people, the citizens, who are forced to, through their taxes, shoulder the cost of cleanup. These companies have been able to get away with it for many years now.
We got into recycling because we thought it was the right thing to do. Of course, it is a disposal service. At its core, it's taking stuff that people don't want anymore and trying to do something better than landfill with it. You can see the range of things that are coming out of people's houses. 10, 15 years ago, this would have had a lot more aluminum, a lot more glass. It's amazing how many things have moved to plastic.
Plastic can be recycled. But actually, most plastic is very hard to recycle. So this is data from the World Economic Forum. It shows that 32% of plastic packaging ends up littering the environment. 40% is sitting in a landfill somewhere. 14% is incinerated. 14% is recycled, but only 2% is effectively recycled. Effectively recycled means that it's recycled into something that's actually as useful as what it was before. Most of it is downcycled, meaning that it becomes something worse. Unlike glass and metals, plastics degrade when they're recycled. Most recycled plastic is only recycled once before ending up in landfills, incinerators, and the environment.
Cities around us had kind of caved to the Collect All Plastics campaign of the American Chemistry Council.
Plastics recycling is pretty cool, and today we're recycling more and more. Recycling plastics is a fairly simple process.
In 2013, under significant pressure from our city council, we began accepting non-bottle mixed rigid plastic. So all the plastic containers, berry containers, keg cups, plastic cold cups, you know, from Starbucks. Procter & Gamble wants us all to believe that all their packaged goods are in totally environmentally sound packaging. They want us all using single-use packaged
products so that we're just on the supply chain. It's totally unfair to the cities and the recyclers on the back end, because then everyone says, oh, it's recyclable. You should collect it. Well, then what? We have to pay to sort it. We have to pay to process it. And then we don't have any markets for it. Once we said we would accept it and we would start sorting it and packing it for export, it was just like the floodgates were open. I mean, the tons went up and up and up and up and up. Because China was buying it, there actually was a market for that stuff. And even if we couldn't afford to sort it out here, we could bale it up and ship it in a shipping container over there, and somebody over there would sort it out.
The United States was shipping over 50% of its plastics to China. The situation was very similar in Europe. We were just shipping it all to China. China will deal with it. And we built up these big recycling programs, and everything was about recycle. Recycle, recycle, recycle is the solution to everything, because we had China there. So China's just said, you know what? We're sick of being a dumping ground, and we don't want this stuff introduced into our country.
Before the National Swore an import ban, many of these plastic waste will not be recycled. The useless plastics, many of them are single-use containers, low-value plastics, films. So in general, we see it quite positive. This gives us a chance to upgrade our recycling industry.
The Chinese waste ban has really been a shocking event for Europe. People didn't know that their recycled plastic was actually being shipped to China. The waste that used to be shipped elsewhere is now here for us to deal with, and we have to confront it. Because in Europe, we really have plastic waste piling up.
I see the China thing as a reckoning, because it's all been this false market where we've just been shipping stuff to China.
The stuff's backing up. It's not getting exported. So what's going to happen with it?
When the ban happened in China, businessmen went to Thailand, Vietnam, or other countries.
A year ago, China was taking 10 times the amount of plastic they're taking today. And that is a massive amount of plastic. So if you think we're just going to take it from China and ship it to Thailand or Indonesia or Vietnam, they don't have that kind of capacity today. So whatever kind of infrastructure is being developed has got to be pretty ad hoc. You know, could range from somebody's backyard to a partly covered warehouse. And that is very concerning.
Yeah, it's from Australia. Toronto. This is Nestle from UK. Yeah, this one from Oregon. From New Zealand.
What do you think somebody's really gonna do with this? It's all different colors. It's got film and plastic. You got 7 different kinds of resin. This stuff's been printed on, so there's ink in the plastic. You know, what are you really gonna make with it? And they have to be able to tell the difference between this clear plastic and this clear plastic, which look the same to you and me, but they're not. And so how do they do that? They have special tests. They can hear it, or they'll light it on fire and smell the smoke. That's gotta be good for your health. When you sort this stuff out, the next thing then is to take those sorted materials and chip it up into a little quarter-sized flake, is what they call it, and then wash it. Well, what's happening with all that wash water? Is that just getting dumped into somebody else's drinking water? Or is it being dumped into an estuary and polluting the estuary with soaps and food and pollutants? And what about when you melt the plastic? Because the next thing you do is you take that flake and you melt it down and extrude it out into these long spaghetti chains, and then you chop those up into little pellets or nurdles. And when you melt it, a lot of these plastics release toxic volatile organic compounds, VOCs, that are not good to breathe. The problem is that there's no place for this stuff to go.
Personally, I got into this movement because I was passionate about going to forests and mountains. Now it's a lot more personal for me. This is about survival. These materials are affecting an ecosystem. They are affecting a community. The entire economy around recycling is possible because we have poverty. They work for very low cost.
The most difficult part of waste sorting is done by the waste picker, who are mostly women, mostly marginalized, and they also get the least benefit from the system. If they were not there, the entire recycling pyramid would have collapsed. If we go back 17 years, there was not so much plastic that was found. It was mostly metal, iron, aluminium. Now they are doing 83 kind of separation within plastic itself.
We had double digits in Asia Pacific. We have double digits in other parts of the world. But it's because you've got a growing economy and you've got a change in markets. People are moving from fresh foods that are not processed to packaged.
Things like fast foods, packaged food, processed foods. These are new to India because Indians like to eat fresh food. India is a place where people naturally reuse things. Nothing was thrown away. It is not a throwaway society because it is not a consumerist society to begin with. That sense of thrift, that sense of carefulness, that respect for materials is going away, and that's a terrible loss. We do need plastics, but plastics can be used for high-tech things.
Plastic holds the promise of a better world. From the ambulance to the emergency room, plastics make it possible.
The industry likes to talk about all the advanced products and life-saving devices that plastics contribute to, which is true.
From heart valves to helmets, can you think of one material that does more?
But what makes up the bulk of demand for plastic right now is packaging. Pieces of plastic that will get used once and thrown away and never used again, and in most cases never cleaned up.
The fast-moving consumer goods in India, almost 100% are packed in one-time use plastics. For example, 1 rupee sachet for a shampoo, or 1 rupee sachet with oil.
They wanted essentially to capture the poor sectors of the market. And to do that, they came up with sachets.
Sachets come in multi-layer of materials, plastic, aluminum, or a bit of paper. It comes in small volume for single use and is meant to be disposed right after. Protects my clothes better. Powerful bungalow now.
The population pyramid is so geared towards consumerism in the future, and that must be exciting. I just wondered how high up the list of emerging markets Africa is for you.
It's very high up. It's one of our growth opportunities in the future.
Our markets are just flooded with this. We already had an existing system. The previous traditional stores, they were a perfect example of alternate delivery system. It's everything still unpacked.
I remember bringing glass to buy soy sauce or oil that we'll use for the day. But now you have soy sauce, you have oil that comes in pouches that are meant to be thrown right after.
When these global companies came in, we were happy to see that, okay, we are also getting the same quality of life enjoyed by the West. And now we realize that there is a double standard.
Working in this global movement is allowing us to point at the companies in Europe when they have this green discourse, and we can tell them, this is maybe what you're doing here, but this is not what you're doing in other parts of the world. And if you want to be credible, you will have to align your actions everywhere with what you're saying.
So this is a Head and Shoulders, bought in India. It's multi-layered, it's non-recyclable. And this is what we find on the shelves in Belgium and in most of Europe. So same product, same brand, same company. different format, recyclable bottle. The producer has paid a fee to cover part of the waste collection and waste management costs. While here, you have absolutely nothing. It's not covered at all. So yeah, in a very country where they have to implement waste management and waste collection system and they need money and funding to build these infrastructures, the producers are not contributing to the end of life of this product, while in Europe, applying a double standard, they are.
Ironically, Asia has been identified as a key source of the problem of plastic pollution in the oceans.
About 60% of plastic in the ocean comes from five countries in Southeast Asia.
When in fact the decisions are made in the boardrooms of companies in the West.
There's a real problem of blame when it comes to plastic pollution. When you have companies like Unilever, Nestle, and Procter & Gamble, and all of these other multinationals going into these markets, aggressively marketing single service products on populations that have no way of dealing with it. Maybe just not so long ago, everything was packaged in natural products. Maybe they live on a tiny island that doesn't have a formalized system of waste collection. And then you're saying that they're at fault for this. And on top of that, we are shipping our waste there to be treated. This is absolutely a Western problem that we have exported to other parts of the world, and now we have the cheek to say that they are the problem.
Pampers? No washing, no mess, you just use them once. Pampers, Procter & Gamble's discovery that makes diapers old-fashioned. Just follow the directions and flush away.
We can find a lot of spots like this along this river.
One of the biggest questions that we're facing is how do we get out of the fossil fuel economy? I've heard some criticism that the concern about plastic pollution is a distraction from the bigger problem of climate change. But my conclusion from doing this reporting is it's all part of the same problem.
Recently, we've discovered that the seven most produced and consumed types of plastic produce greenhouse gases. As plastic degrades in the environment, it will just be producing more and more gases with time.
We are really making the connection between the plastics issue and what's happening with the climate movement, because all of their efforts can be completely offset by the fact that the fossil fuel that we're not using anymore for transport and energy is now being used to produce cheap plastics and is going to be burnt and is going to release CO2 in the atmosphere.
If we don't do things right, all this plastic might end up in incinerators. And that's something we have to watch closely. It's a real danger.
More and more community leaders, entrepreneurs, and people like you and me are starting to think about trash as a valuable energy resource. It's called energy recovery. And simply put, it's the process that turns solid waste into energy.
Sounds good. Maybe. But there's also a lot of toxic crap in there that you don't want in your air.
The first thing we do when we get up is look out of the window to see how much smoke is coming out of that plant. It's like living next to a volcano, actually. You know, you never know. Sometimes large, copious amounts of smoke come out of these two chimneys. They can be seen for miles around. It burns 2,000 tons of unsegregated waste per day. A large component of that is just plastic. It's a cocktail of every kind of dangerous thing that you can think of. Dioxins, furans, lead, cadmium, mercury, all of that. We sent samples of the fly ash to a lab in London. They said, please evacuate immediately. That's what they said.
We are seeing a lot of changes since the incinerator came in. You find a lot of people who never ever had any respiratory problem, they are coming with respiratory distress. Then there are severe dermatitis and a lot of skin rashes which were not there before. These dioxins cause infertility and even long-term effects on our fetuses. They are hormone disruptors and also they are carcinogenic. And that is proven. There's nothing to be proved.
It started so gradually that we did not notice the process. But now that we look back, it's so clear. I grew up here, so I have a lot of memories attached to this place. Before, I remember we used to play outside. And now kids stopped coming outside and playing. So that is how we were caged inside our own homes. When I went to the doctor, he told me, it looks from your lungs that either you're a smoker or you work in the mines.
The plant projects itself as doing a great service to the community by getting rid of their garbage. But this is the wrong way to do it. The main thing that this incinerator does is it reduces the volume of your garbage. So instead of having a mountain of garbage, you have a hillock of fly ash and bottom ash, which is very, very toxic. They don't want the recycling to happen. They chase away the waste pickers. They need that plastic so that it'll burn everything else. Plastic burns, and burns very well, because it's made of petrochemicals. They want you to use more plastic because that's what is their fuel.
It's basically a trash monster that will just desperately eat as much plastic as it can. And not only will it be happy to get non-recyclable packaging, but all the plastic that's going for recycling currently will essentially be institutionally diverted, even if it's at the cost of the environment, human development, and economic inclusion.
Groups that have been fighting local struggles against particular segments of the fossil fuel economy are now linking together in this much broader movement that looks at the whole chain of damage from resource extraction to waste incinerators. These disparate struggles that seem unconnected. A neighborhood in the Philippines that's awash in plastic trash, a pipeline in Pennsylvania, a single refinery in Texas. They're all part of this web of plastics infrastructure that is all working together to massively increase the amount of plastics out in the world.
Why is it that we're seeing so much more plastics entering the environment?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Fracking. It's making natural gas cheaper than it's ever been.
We're talking about double-digit gains in businesses that I didn't think had even single-digit growth. How are you putting up these numbers?
Well, we have a very focused team, Jim. We also built a lot of assets on the U.S. Gulf Coast to take advantage of shale gas.
The Energy Policy Act of 2005 provides incentives for oil refineries to expand their capacity. The bill includes tax incentives to encourage new construction of natural gas pipelines.
The United States, North America, sits on a very large hydrocarbon resource base.
When we see the fact that we have low-priced natural gas, which we think will be around for a long time, that is leading to a flood of new investments.
If we have availability of cheap fossil fuel, we're going to have availability of dirty chemicals and of cheap plastics.
Maximizing the value of all the molecules from a barrel of crude oil. That's been foundational for how we've approached the chemical business for decades.
And this is where the straw in the turtle's nose comes from. It comes from petrol, oil, gas.
Es plástico.
Es plástico?
Is it a freaking straw? I'm so sorry, baby.
I think people don't necessarily think about what plastics are made of or where plastics come from. Other than on the shelf of a grocery store or some sort of a market. But the reality is that the chemicals that are needed to create plastics come from the shale formations, from these oil and gas pockets in the rock. You can't talk about one without the other. These oil and gas pockets, you also have chemicals like benzene and toluene and ethyl benzene and xylene that are all extremely harmful for your health. Plastics doesn't just cause pollution in the ocean or on the ground. It's also causing pollution where it's coming from, at the point of extraction. I work with community members that are living 500 feet from a facility that's the size of a football field. Now some of the residents depend on medication to get through the day because their headaches are so bad. or they have chronic respiratory issues and so they can't breathe. Their lives were dramatically changed over a period of 5 or 6 years.
This is our dream home. We thought we were coming into a great area to where we could live out our years. And then this stuff started turning up. You're not showing my face, are you?
No.
Okay. The pollution has gotten way out of hand. Everybody has to drink bottled water. There's a water well on my place. We don't drink the water because we know damn well we can't use that water. We don't know what's coming out of that flare. And they won't tell us. You know, I think that these oil companies are, they think they're above the law.
When we talk about a community like Karnes County, we're talking about the effects of extracting for the chemicals that we need to make plastics.
I spent a fair amount of time in the oil and gas industry. My time as Secretary of State isn't that far from removed from what I did running that small company. New drilling technology and greater energy output are transforming American life and lives all around the world. It took our shale producers and risk takers, and it took Congress lifting the oil export ban in 2015, which I voted for. You should all see me as I walk out and say thanks.
I think the piece of reporting that surprised me the most for this story was learning about the scale of what's planned for the upper Ohio River Valley, so spanning Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia. They're really talking about a brand new petrochemical corridor, which is unprecedented in that area.
Come here. Get over here. Get over here. My name is Elise Gerhart. I'm 31 years old. I live in Huntington, Pennsylvania. I was born here, raised here. My mom called me to tell me happy birthday, and then she informed me that there was a company who wanted to build a pipeline through this property here, where I grew up. So the Mariner East Project, it's a project built to transport natural gas liquids to an industrial complex near Philadelphia. Those would go from the port there all the way across the Atlantic to a facility in Scotland so that they can make plastic. The company puts out all kinds of propaganda saying that the project has something to do with American energy independence, that it has to do with people heating their homes during the winter. And none of that is true.
America relies on energy. We get it to you safely. We are Sunoco Pipeline.
It makes me really angry because as soon as I started doing research on this project, it was very clear what the intent was. You know, it's publicly available, and yet we have these judges saying that those companies can take our property for their own private use to make plastic. Now, I've only been paying attention to pipelines for a couple years, and it seems to happen every couple of months. There's like an enormous pipeline explosion, like a major incident. I mean, people's houses burning down, people being severely injured.
A gas line outside Columbus, Ohio explodes, destroying two homes.
See that explode?
Breaking news, firefighters are racing to contain a deadly gas explosion in Kentucky, flames spreading to homes, forcing evacuations.
I don't know what it's going to feel like to try and live here every day, knowing that a leak or explosion could happen at any time with no warning, because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you don't know until it's too late.
If you look at the projected blast zone area, and I have to laugh because Sunoco doesn't refer to it as a blast zone area, it's a buffer area, is roughly 1,000 feet on either side of the pipeline. So from where the pipeline is in relationship to our house, we're well within the blast zone area.
So myself and a couple other people climbed into some of the trees and occupied them so that they couldn't cut them down. And we had lots of people just start coming through who wanted to help out. But they tried to intimidate people. I was followed to work.
They flew drones up around the house, just looking at everything. Energy Transfer Partners paid someone to create this fake Facebook page saying that I was an eco-terrorist trying to bring violence into my community and that I need to be stopped. They put my partner on there, they put friends of ours on there, they put our vehicles on there, posted our address. So I had people messaging us, threatening to rape us, to kill us. I'm not that strong that that's not gonna affect me. They got endless resources. You know, we have to live our lives. Like, I had to go to work. So they came, they cut down the trees. Even if you can talk to people and explain to them that this isn't carrying home heating fuel, it's not carrying gasoline for your car, then people start bringing in these arguments about plastic and about how plastic is everywhere in our everyday lives, so we must need it. I think people have a hard time picturing what life would be like without plastic. And that's where I think more people are actually duped.
Houston is the home of the largest petrochemical complex in the nation.
This is what plastic smells like. This is what plastic feels like. This is what plastic looks like from our end.
Some of the daily emissions include benzene, styrene, 1,3-butadiene, hydrogen sulfide, hydrogen cyanide.
What we have tried to put in place here is, again, is a model that will ensure that EPA prioritizes chemicals.
Most of these chemicals are not monitored, and there are more chemicals that are delisted from EPA's watch list than they are added.
I want to thank Administrator Curry from the EPA, all the great folks that have helped us to clear the way so that ExxonMobil can make this multi-billion dollar investment.
It's not uncommon to talk to folks in the community and have multiple stories of childhood leukemia, brain cancer, low birth weights or sterility, lack of motor skills, developmental issues, speech impediments.
We have reduced our air emissions at this site by about 50%. I have never seen a project with a better economic and environmental story.
Every time EPA's watch list shrinks, air quality gets better. Why? Because it's not being monitored. Both of my parents are immigrants. They left Mexico to make our lives better. Their parents left the rural parts of Mexico to go into the cities because life in rural Mexico was difficult, because oil companies were going in. That story isn't done. There's another family that's living with that, and there's another family that's living next to a refinery, and there's another family that's struggling. It takes outside organizations to come in to inform residents about what they're living with on a daily basis.
So we are in the East End. It is a cultural hub for everything Mexican. You have the art, you have the food. It's a place brimming with culture. It's a beautiful place. And we are down the street from a Valero plant. That's what there is a lot of here, a lot of plants. I think the farthest that I've ever lived from a plant has been 2.5 miles. My friends are having kids, and it's, hey, you know, so-and-so's kid has cancer, so-and-so's kid has leukemia. And it's sad that that's our new normal.
I'm just gonna start running it through here. Okay, I'm bringing it up, just see what we got. Oh God, yeah, there's all kinds of pellets. Diane, you want this?
Yeah, we'll take a sample. We found fish with pellets in their gullets. We've had oystermen who say they, when they're shucking open in oysters, they're finding pellets inside it. On the bay, you got Formosa plastic, We got Invista, we got BP, we got DuPont, we got Dow Chemical. You add all of that up, easily you can get 50 million gallons a day of toxins being discharged into estuaries.
I worked 25 years at the plant as a supervisor, but I had to get out of there because I got tired of the bullcrap lying for them, because that's all you do out there at that plant is lie. And, you know, nobody out there can speak. They'll fire you right on the spot.
You can pull anything up and find pellets. See all the pellets? It's covered in pellets. You look down there, there's a harbor down there. There's no fish houses anymore, and there's no shrimpers. You gotta do something. So we just started sampling. And eventually, we filed the suit. When I first started, I had a helicopter land in my front yard, shot and killed the dog, shot at the house, and then my shrimp boat was sabotaged. So they did a few things. I don't think my story is unique at all. I think there are thousands in little rural communities where the company has a heavy hand, especially along the Gulf Coast.
What's going on here in Houston highlights not only the scale of the problem, but its immediacy. The oil and gas industry, the American Petroleum Institute, the American Chemistry Council, they see the shale gas boom as a renaissance for plastics and petrochemicals in the U.S.
ExxonMobil estimates that the global demand for chemicals will double within the next 20 years. That's more than the forecasts for energy and GDP growth over the same period.
They're doubling down on plastics. I think they're worried that we're gonna stop burning so much fossil fuel. I hope that's their worry, and I hope they're right. But I think they see plastic as a way to hedge their bet.
Our expectation is global fuels demand growth will actually start to decline. And so where would you anticipate additional growth in one place is a petrochemical market.
Plastics and other petrochemicals present an opportunity for these big integrated oil majors to keep up demand. And so we're really seeing this trend towards investment in the petrochemical space.
During the course of these meetings, President Trump and members of his cabinet agreed the U.S.-Saudi partnership should be taken to new heights.
The latest estimate from the American Chemistry Council is that $194 billion will be invested in the U.S. into 325 new or expanded facilities for petrochemicals, primarily for plastics, between now and 2025. That's a remarkable expansion. We're already producing more plastics in the United States than we can use. So the question is, where is that plastic going? It's flowing to Asia, it's flowing to Europe, it's flowing into ever new product streams. This highlights a really fundamental truth about the plastics crisis and about plastics as a product. To a far greater extent than in any other product chain, plastics are driven not by the demand for them, but by the supply. This is the story of plastics. It is fossil fuels finding a new form and finding a new place to flow through the economy. This is a crisis that is accelerating literally by the day as we speak. Exxon opens a new plant here. Chevron builds a new plant there. Total builds yet another. We're seeing the same thing happen in the US East Coast. We're seeing the same thing happen in Europe, in the Middle East, in China. This build out is going on, and it's going on now. Once these plants are built, the debt to build them will already have been incurred. And they will squeeze every last ounce of plastic film and plastic packaging out of those plants until they crumble to dust.
We're back with an alarming new report that came out this past week on the state of the world's oceans, specifically the finding that they contain far more plastic than scientists had first thought.
The surge of attention to plastic pollution is pretty striking.
Searching for fish, but finding an ocean of plastic trash.
About 8 million metric tons go into the ocean every year. That's the equivalent of one city garbage truck dumping a load of plastic into the ocean every minute of every day.
Celebrities urging people to give up using things like plastic straws and cups.
By 2050, there will be more plastic waste in the world's oceans than fish.
These pictures after its death show the 80 plastic bags found inside the whale.
Este mar de plásticos apareció en las costas de la República Dominicana hace unos meses.
It's getting into the food that we end up eating.
The polyester fibers that you take into your lungs, they're small enough to cross the blood-brain barrier.
The five gyres, giant swirling bodies of water where plastic accumulates.
When I mention plastic to younger people, they say plastic is that giant island that's the size of Antarctica in an ocean, and that's what plastic did. It wrecked the environment. But the world is still going toward plastic.
We do have a plastic waste problem, and at this point in time, I've never seen the industry more aligned about tackling that problem.
They're mostly making these statements that are quite normative. We'll look into this, we're committed.
The chemical industry has products and processes that can help address these sustainability issues.
We believe in sustainable practices and sustainable business growth.
But that hasn't translated into what the step-by-step plan is.
Graham von Hoff, who's the executive vice president of Shell's chemical division, wrote, "I find the issue of unmanaged plastic waste deeply concerning." And then he adds, "The challenge is not with plastics themselves, it's what happens after people use them." I can't speculate about what the executives at petrochemical companies actually believe, but it's certainly true that in their communications and their actions, most of them indicate that while they might generously offer to help with the cleanup problem, there's nothing wrong with the product or with the companies that are making the product. The fault lies with countries that have inadequate waste recycling infrastructure.
I think everyone agrees that plastic waste does not belong in the ocean or the environment. So I'm very happy to announce today the formation of the Alliance to End Plastic Waste. This can bring together companies that make plastic and those that handle plastic after the use. We're ready to invest over $1.5 billion to identify projects and fund projects to really get at solving solutions.
I think if you look at some of the industry-backed plans, the Alliance to End Plastic Waste, they want to put significant investment into recycling and waste collection infrastructure. And that's great where it happens. But that's not going to reach everywhere. It's definitely not on the same scale or even close to the scale of the amount of plastic that is projected to be produced in the coming decade based upon all this new investment in infrastructure. The metaphor I use in the piece is it's like trying to bail out a bathtub with a teaspoon while the tap is on full blast. And certainly we see that this distraction has been effective in terms of media coverage. There is a lot of coverage about cleanup. Whether it's the big ocean cleanup that has a lot of big money behind it, or whether it's smaller efforts, whether it's industry investments in cleanup, that definitely has dominated the narrative. That famous quote, "The future of plastics is in the trash can," it's no secret that the industry has for decades understood that the way to profit more is to get people to use more plastic. Their incentive is to get us to use more, and if we throw it away, that creates PR problems for them. But economically, it's great if we just keep using single-use products.
So if we stopped to pick up everything on the way out there, we'd never make it out past the jetty. So we have to leave some things by the wayside.
I'm captain of the oceanographic research vessel Algita and founder of Algalita Marine Research and Education. I'm known for working well offshore of the coastal ocean in what are known as the oceanic gyres. In 1997, I decided to take a shortcut and cut across this vast expanse, which was basically 1,000 miles in diameter. and I couldn't come on deck without seeing a single piece of plastic float by within 5 minutes. It's proliferated so fast, within 20 years from my time of discovering that till today, I feel I underestimated the actual danger. And the aha moment was the first time we threw that mannitol in the ocean and pulled it in, it was full of plastic fragments. That's what blew my mind, when we realized no matter where you're gonna throw that net in out here, you're gonna find that stuff.
So we just pulled in the trawl.
This is all plastic that we caught at the surface of the ocean.
Wow, that's a lot. You'll see the nurdles, which are the pre-production resin pellets. For majority of all of our plastics we've ever owned, it started out as the nurdles. Look at that separation between the plastic layer. Look how many different layers there are of materials there. See how the plastic's separating from that foil? So how easy do you think it is for the recyclers to do that?
Oh, we love our sachets. Just about anywhere you look now, you can find plastic, if you look especially at the nanoscale materials, which are now beginning to enter into the web of life itself.
When you realize how widespread this issue is and how small the particles are, you realize that cleanup is really just a great way to see how bad the problem is. We cannot rely on it as a solution.
There are solutions that have been proven to work. There are cities working towards zero waste. My vision for the future is all cities are going zero waste. And that means that all that we use, all that we produce, can either be composted or recycled. And all cities have the capacity to manage these compostables and these recyclables. Currently, we still have residual waste. These are products or packaging that can neither be composted nor recycled. But the beauty of a zero waste program is that we are not hiding these products. If you are collecting resources and not waste, it's not expensive. One example is San Fernando City in the Philippines. Without a zero waste program, San Fernando would be spending 70 million pesos per year just to collect their waste and dump it in a landfill. With the zero waste program, they were able to reduce it to 12 million. That translates to about 58 million pesos savings for one city alone.
There is only one solution to manage garbage, is to implement zero waste management. It's really a part of a solution economically and for the environment.
We're proud of San Fernando with their 78% waste diversion, but the reality is that you have that remaining 22% that San Fernando cannot manage, that no one can manage. The Zero Waste Program allows us to identify which products are beyond the capacity of communities to manage.
Industries are going to have to take this into account. If their product isn't able to be recycled, not only in the country where it's produced or designed, but in the country where it ends up, then they shouldn't be producing that kind of product.
Right now, we are having a brand audit in which we are trying to identify the brands which contribute the most to plastic waste, which is generated at the household level. We are trying to generate enough baseline data to enable the government to take a stand so they can follow guidelines for implementing EPR, which is Extended Producer Responsibility. When we say extend the producer responsibility, we try to transfer the responsibility of handling discards of branded products back to the producer. For example, if you're buying a packet of chips, we are essentially buying the chips and not the packaging which comes along with it. So the manufacturer should take the responsibility for either collecting them back or should support the government in treating them. So this is what we dream by implementing extend the producer responsibility. From what we see right here, there are five main contributors to the majority of the plastic waste generated: Unilever, ITC, Nestle, Milma, and PepsiCo. And we are getting similar feedback from different brand audits conducted all over the country, where the same names are coming up as the top brands.
We know who they are. We've been trying to work with them. They have to step up, and they have to own the problem.
We cannot be forever supporting the bottom line of these companies. That has got to stop now. They need to be given the bill.
We've got to pass legislation, and we've got to create public opinion to reduce waste.
They have a role to play if they want to adapt, but if they don't adapt, we should not expect the Coca-Colas or the PepsiCos or the Unilevers of this world to be there in 20 years.
To continue creating products on the basis of petrochemicals is not embracing the full potential of the opportunities that we see elsewhere. We're almost there that you can create packaging that has nothing to do with plastics. We're almost there.
If you can use less material, for sure, that's always number one. But for everything else, biodegradable and bio-based plastic could be a good solution in the future. People always say like, oh, Molly, I thought of you. I was at CVS and I bought a biodegradable shampoo bottle. And I'm like, I know exactly what you bought. It's not biodegradable. Just because something's made from corn or plants does not mean it's biodegradable. So we see a lot of things like bio-PET on the market, for instance. And bio-PET is the same carbon chain that's in conventional PET. And you're not using ancient fossil carbon to make that material, but it's the exact same carbon chain. It's not gonna be biodegradable. So those two things are completely unrelated, biodegradable and bio-based. But we really need to think about both. What we're going up against, the incumbent, persistent petrochemical-based plastics, this is a massive infrastructure challenge.
If we really want to completely transform this industry, we have to create that demand and say to the producers, you must buy this much recycled resin instead of virgin. Then you're going to see demand. Then you're going to see investment in recycling. Now, that being said, it's not all about recycling.
I don't think we recycle our way out of this problem. We gotta reduce and reuse our way out of this. And that's definitely not what Dow and DuPont and 3M and Target and Procter & Gamble and Starbucks are thinking.
The question is, are we going to see a world of multinationals in 20 or 30 years' time, or we want to see a world where actually you have a lot more alternative delivery systems, business models that go a lot more small scale and actually building on the communities?
The world that I hope to see is one where your beauty care products or your drinks or whatever else that you're buying is coming in reusable packaging. And we have more localized systems so that we break free from these huge multinational companies who have massive supply chains that force them to rely on plastic packaging.
At least we can turn off the tap, right? That's the least that we can do, the very least that we can do. People are thinking that prevention is radical, something that comes after recycling. It's not. It's supposed to be the essential thing to do first and foremost. There has to be a policy. That's the only way that you can get massive scale conversions to single-use plastic free.
Before we passed the plastic bag reduction law in California,
This would have been full of plastic bags too. So it's pretty awesome that there aren't very many. Because those plastic bags were a nightmare. They gummed up everything. And it's a success story that gives us some ideas about how we might deal with some of these other materials.
What we did is we looked at which single-use plastics items can be easily replaced, like straws, Q-tips, plastic cutlery, plastic plates, etc. So we could ban those products. And then you have products that are not as easily replaceable. And there you need to help industry to try and develop other products that could replace these products. Then also, what has been very successful are programs to recollect plastic bottles. You get a collection of over 90%. All these things combined should be one strategy. This is not a Europe-centric or Western-centric issue. In some African countries, governments are willing to be more radical than Europe on single-use plastics.
Rwanda is a role model. Since the ban was introduced 10 years ago, countries around the world have since also banned plastic bags.
The public is happy to hear about these bans taking place. And companies are really afraid. They're suddenly realizing this is really serious. Without the legislation, we have nothing. Because then you're asking corporations to voluntarily do the right thing. They're not going to do that. But if everybody is forced to do it, and they all have to pay, they're going to come together. And those costs that were externalized in the past and basically borne by poor communities suffering with all this marine litter or municipalities having to deal with expensive recycling and disposal programs or large incinerators that they have to keep feeding, those are externalized costs that companies are profiting from. Now we're going to give them back those costs and say, you know what? It's your problem now. You deal with it. Are you still going to do business the same way you do business now? Or are you going to redesign your product so you're going to reduce those costs and it's actually going to be more environmentally friendly? I believe we're at a tipping point right now. I've seen more policy change globally in the last 8 months than I've seen in 20 years of my career. Because not only are governments getting pissed off, but companies are recognizing they can't get away with it anymore.
Look at our globe. It's a water world. So if you imagine that we are in a womb filled with water, whatever I do here is going to affect every single life form in this earth. Whether a person in Europe or in US or in India or in Africa or in Philippines or in Indonesia, it's a life. We need to bring in that kind of a spirit of unity across boundaries because these toxins do not understand political boundaries.
So many parts of our economy, so many places around the world are dependent on this relatively small group of corporations who are making a tremendous amount of money poisoning the rest of us. And so figuring out how to break out of that cycle, that's the project of our lifetime.
Plastics are treated as a product that miraculously appears from nowhere, and it goes to nowhere. That invisibility, that magic nature of plastics is something that the oil and gas industry has perpetuated and promoted very effectively for decades. But what was once invisible is becoming visible. The plastic crisis doesn't start when the plastics enter the ocean. It starts when the oil and the gas leave the wellhead, and it keeps on being a problem at every step along the way. So if you want to stop plastics, if you want to truly confront the plastics crisis, fight to end fossil fuel subsidies. Make companies accountable for the life cycle impacts of their products. The moment that Exxon, the moment that Shell, the moment that Chevron and Dow and DuPont own the impacts of these products, the plastics crisis will be over, and not before then.
Now it may be kind of an utopian idea, but I think that circular economy is possible. Zero waste is possible.
It's not
reasonable at all that we continue to live like this and expect to survive. We're ruining the planet that gives us life, and we're ruining the oceans that give us fish. We're ruining the rivers that give us clean water.
I don't think they can keep on tricking people forever.